You are listening to Truth Jihad Radio. If you like this kind of radio, please go to truthjihad.com and subscribe or offer a one-time donation through the PayPal button. It's only through your help that I can continue with this very important work of pursuing the truth wherever it leads.
Stay inside. Don't drink or eat anything.
That's an important question. I understand that. Highest moment the last 8 years.
Highest last 8 years. Well, I think the most important, the most compelling was 9/11 itself.
Welcome to the live version of Truth Jihad Radio. I'm Kevin Barrett. I'm here live every Friday evening, 8 to 10 p.m. Eastern, 7 to 9 p.m. Central, 6 to 8 p.m. Mountain, 5 to 7 p.m. Pacific, and I could go on, but we U.S. Americans are pretty U.S.-ocentric. So I'll just give you the four main time zones here in the United States of America and try to help make America great again. Okay. So there he is. Hey, Chris, don't hang up. We got you. You're live on the air.
Well, I'm on the landline now.
That's good. You're still live on the air.
Oh, fine. Oh, gotcha. Okay, great. Great.
Okay. So I just mentioned to the audience that even though I'm a proud Irish-American Muslim, and I am more conscious of my Irish heritage than of any other aspect of my European heritage, I haven't really studied this Irish Holocaust issue. You know, I've known for a long time that the British had a hand in killing a huge number of people, that it was, it wasn't just a natural disaster. I've known that, and I've known the basics, but I hadn't ever really looked at the details till I looked at your work, and it's quite astounding. So maybe you could introduce the listeners to this. 1845 to 1850, this famine in Ireland was not just the result of a crop failure.
Correct. And I must say, I have been to school in the United States and in Ireland and was taught famine on both sides of the Atlantic. The Marist brother who taught me in Castlereagh, County Roscommon, just a few years ago, was asked by an ex-student, "Brother, if you're now saying it was a genocide, why did you teach us all famine?" And Brother Enda said, "I had no choice. I had to teach the curriculum as provided to me by the government." Now, I must say, he was a religious person whose primary responsibility should have been to his maker, to his spiritual God. And yet he lied to his students about genocide his entire teaching career. And I walked past a mass grave. We lived out the so-called Workhouse Road from Castlereagh, and I walked past a series of mass graves, as a matter of fact, every day to and from, and we knew they were there. But if in a history examination, if I had ever mentioned what I knew, I would not get a passing grade.
Wow. That's crazy, isn't it?
Yes, it is. Ireland might be the only country on earth that to this day conceals a 5.2 million genocide of its own people.
That's interesting. The 5.2 million people essentially murdered by an imposed famine with British troops stealing the food from Ireland. So, and that, interestingly, that's actually just about the same number given by Raoul Hilberg, a Jewish academician who's known as the father of Jewish Holocaust studies. You know, a lot of people think that the Jewish Nazi Holocaust was 6 million people. That's kind of the mythical number that's floated out there. And anybody who questions that is thrown into a concentration. I mean, they're thrown into jail in certain European countries. But Raoul Hilberg, the father of Holocaust studies, says it was actually closer to 5 million. And that's pretty much the number that you're getting for the Irish Holocaust.
Yes, I must say that I've published a book recently relatively recently, and I did so only because my pamphlet, The Mass Graves of Ireland, in which there were hundreds of thousands put into circulation by people who were photocopying and further distributing. But then about 15 years ago, that became www.irishholocaust.org. And it then went around the world and is still doing some good. But it didn't stop the, quote, famine, unquote, literatures. And so I had to write this book to try to finally silence them. It has not done so. They have, in fact, they are mounting a campaign against what I'm doing. There's a double-decker bus going around Dublin, funded by the government, that is all about the Irish famine. And those who were promoting famine, many of them, including the treasonous Sinn Féin, who led the surrender of the six counties of Northern Ireland to the Britain, they say, well, we're not part of the famine liars. We call it the Great Hunger, or Irish Gorta Mór, and that way they claim to be somehow superior to the liars. But Gorta Mór and Great Hunger are merely synonyms for famine. They both exculpate the perpetrators. And so I feel that there are only a few labels that can be properly applied. And one is, of course, genocide, coined by Raphael Lemkin post-World War II in order to get the U.S. Congress to acknowledge what Hitler had done to the Jews. And others, of course, but that they don't dwell on the others. Then there's a policy of extermination, which was referred to by letter from one British bureaucrat in Ireland to another at the time while it was ongoing, policy of extermination. But that's a three-word label. And then there is Holocaust. And actually, Holocaust was used starting in 1845 and was the label used by a number of different writers, including the Irish Examiner newspaper at the time, throughout while it was going on. So I happen to prefer, on the basis of precedent usage, I prefer Holocaust.
That's interesting. The roots of that go back to the meaning of a burnt offering as a kind of a sacrifice. And I think that's problematic because the way it got picked up for this genocide, ethnic cleansing and mass murder of Jews in Germany. And of course, a lot of the details there are disputed. Let's be honest about that. But there clearly was an ethnic cleansing and a mass murder of Jews in Germany. And this notion of a Holocaust was that word then was applied to this. And a burnt offering or human sacrifice implies a kind of a religious act, a religious connotation. And that's been used to create a sort of a sacred mythology that supports the current genocide against the Palestinians. And so it seems to me that making this kind of crime against humanity into a sort of a religious symbol has problems. And so I don't know, I'm a little uncomfortable with the word Holocaust being applied to these kinds of events.
Yes. Well, I must say there is some etymological rationale for it in Ireland, in that many, many thousands of homes, and they averaged seven persons per home at the time, were cremated. Everyone within found dead by their neighbors. Instead of running the risk of handling the bodies and burying them, they torched the roof thatch and cremated them. So tens of thousands, or if not hundreds of thousands, were cremated.
Really?
So there is an etymological basis for it, and I'm not sure whether that prompted the writers starting in 1845 to use Holocaust in Ireland. It might be that they reached to the Bible for a word for a deed so shocking that there was no word for it, and they just adopted it willy-nilly. I do not know what motivated them at the time, but the Cork Examiner, it was then called the Cork from Cork City, Cork Examiner newspaper, now the Irish Examiner, they repeatedly used it in the most explicit form regarding these drastic crimes committed against the entire Irish nation. I found out about this. My grandfather died in 1924. I wasn't born until over a decade later. And I wanted to do his biography to learn a little more about him in order to have it for my cousins and nieces and nephews. So he had been a British soldier. I've learned to be ashamed of that. I do know, however, that the life was so dire under British rule in Ireland that this was a means of surviving, and he kept his siblings alive by his meager army pay. He served in, he fought the Maoris in New Zealand and helped to rob the Aborigines in Australia, and the same thing in India, and he marched with his 40th Regiment afoot when Victoria was made the Empress of India in 1875. He retired in 1881, the year that the British government stopped using the cat of nine tails as a means of military discipline. But I was doing my grandfather's biography, and I was shocked to find that his 40th Regiment of Foot that he joined in 1857 had been removing the food from South County Galway when he was 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11 years of age. And I was shocked because I was pretty sure that it was a famine, not necessarily a potato famine, but nevertheless a famine, until I saw this. So I studied further, and I finally found that more than half of the entire British Empire army were in Ireland in those years, removing Ireland's food at gunpoint. And that's not a matter of opinion. That comes from the British government's own records, actually handwritten records at the time. Each year has its own record of where the regiments were, what dates they boarded to go somewhere else, what date they arrived somewhere. They were transferred within Ireland many times, or from Ireland to India or Malta or Trinidad or somewhere, from those places to Ireland. So it was all going on at that time, but meanwhile, the people were dying. I didn't do the only one chapter of the book that is not my work, or not my compilation, better said, because it's essentially a compilation of official records. But the murder toll was done by an Irishman living in England, and he has been around censuses, I think, for many, many years, and he did an entire survey of all of the censuses and all of the work done regarding Irish population in those years. And it like the rest of my book, is the definitive work on the subject. He doesn't make it a hard and fast 5.2 millions. In fact, he ends up, his last sentence says, who can say that it wasn't 6 million? And it could be, but that would be the upper range of the total of murders.
But that's interesting. Today, it so closely matches the total of kind of the orthodox school of thought regarding the Nazi Jewish Holocaust.
Yes, it's just one of those odd features. And another odd feature is that at the time of the starvation, Victoria was being guided by King Leopold I of Belgium. And a few years later, that same King Leopold was guiding his son, King Leopold II, while the same thing was done in the Belgian Congo. It's amazing how this came. And then, there was a Jewish financial advisor that was involved. I don't want to stress, and my book does not stress any kind of a Jewish connection to this, partly because so many people seem to want to make that connection. And it turns out that bankers in London did hold the mortgages on many of the huge estates in Ireland. They were typically tens of thousands of acres. And so we don't know who it was that was pulling the strings as to how the money was collected from the people. Eventually, between 1900 and 1910 mostly, starting at a few years ahead of it and ending a few years after that period, all of Ireland ownership was taken out of the hands of their English landlords and distributed back to the cultivators, to the Irish people again. Today, Ireland is probably Europe's most evenly divided nation in terms of its agricultural land.
Interesting.
Many thousands of families own land, and no one owns a whole lot of it.
Well, how did it fall into the hands of the British and the banksters in the first place?
By robbery. The army went in and took it by force. It was robbery. Their titles were all by robbery.
And what years was that happening?
For hundreds of years, starting in the end of the 1500s, all the way through the 1600s, it became a genocide in the 1700s, and remained so until the landlords left in about 1900.
Interesting. There's a parallel there with Palestine, in that the Zionist movement first got a toehold by going to the Ottoman landlords, who were very lucky if they collected anything from the Palestinian peasants, who were basically subsistence farmers and selling in markets and stuff. And so these Ottomans had technical title to some of the land in Palestine, but they didn't really have much of a claim. They just had these documents from way back when, because the Ottoman Empire said, we own the place, but that it didn't really mean anything. The Palestinian peasants actually had the land. But the Zionists went and paid these landlords for these useless titles to the land, and then they went to Palestine and used the British guns to force the peasants off their land and steal it. But of course, that only got the Zionists 10% of the land before 1948. But that to get that 10%, they had to dispossess and starve an awful lot of people. But what happened to Ireland was actually, in a sense, a much broader scale thing, because that didn't just get 10% of Ireland. That they stole most of Ireland.
Yes, they had the Encyclopedia Britannica actually errs in a few pages apart. One place it says they had 97.5% of the land, and another place they had 97.9% of the land, the English landlords, that is. So they had essentially all of it, and what they didn't have would almost certainly be bog or mountain or something that nobody really wanted. They got it all, and they turned the people into unpaid slaves. They took almost all of their production. By getting titles, we'll say, to... Well, Lord Lucan, Mr. Bingham, had 60,000 some hundred acres in around Castlebar in County Mayo. Another one had 200,000. But this around Castlebar in County Mayo, many people in Chicago are from that area. And he usurped the production of every human being on that 60,000 acres, except bare subsistence food. And if the people built and improved their house, he would be likely to evict them and rent it to a higher price to somebody else. And so all of these incentives worked against production because they were robbed of all of it. It was truly shocking. They eventually ended up living in the holes in the bogs because there was any worthwhile house would be taken from them and rented to somebody else by people who were living in London or Paris or somewhere else. These landlords, many of them, if not the majority, were absentees. They didn't live there. They had British English agents over there collecting the rents for them.
So what
and, of
happened,
course, they used the military. They used the military to do the rent collections.
So during the so-called potato famine, which is really an Irish Holocaust of 1845 to 1850, the tax collection, quote unquote, which is when the people who've stolen this land and claim that it's theirs and taken title to it and say that they own everybody and everything on that land. So essentially they were sending soldiers in to grab the food that was being produced on that land. And their excuse was they're saying they're just collecting the rent.
That is correct. The Irish also, fairly devout Catholics at the time, because the imposed church, the one created by Henry VIII, the Church of England, and I call the Church of Ireland, by the way, officially it's the Church of Ireland, was a church of the landlords in Ireland, but the Irish people were forced to tithe to it. And the tithe was collected off of tillage land, which only the Irish operated. The English in Ireland, those on the land that they did not have worked by the Irish, they just grazed. So they would have Irish herds and shepherds, and they weren't. There were no tithes collected off grazed lands. is collected only off the land that was worked by the Irish. So the Catholics were forced by British law to tithe to the church of their murderers.
No wonder there is so much resentment of the British in Irish culture. And, you know, people who want to understand the troubles that happened within, you know, in recent decades and the, you know, continuing tensions in these communities, we're often told in the mainstream media that this is just a matter of, you know, the Catholics versus the Protestants and some kind of irrational religious war. It has nothing to do with anything real. It's all just about religious ideology. But the reality is that this is really a kind of a struggle of resistance by the people of Ireland who've been resisting their conquerors and exploiters for centuries.
That's correct. In the 1970s, actually in 1968, the people living under British rule in the occupied six counties started to demand the right to vote. Living in the land of their ancestors, they were not allowed to vote as to who would represent them, except a rare few. And so they marched for the vote, and they were bloodily put down by the police and the army. It went on for 6 years. In 1973, all of the Irish were adults, that is, were finally allowed to vote. But the British government responded by calling upon all employers to cease hiring Irish Catholics, that is to say the native Irish and their descendants, to force them into exile and therefore off the voter registration rolls. We in the States couldn't control that, but what we could do was get the American companies who had branches operating there to not participate in that job denial program. And so the McBride principles, named for Sean McBride, whose father was killed in 1916 by the British, executed actually. But it was the McBride principles were adopted from the Sullivan principles for South Africa that did work in South Africa. And they required that the American companies do not participate in that job denial program. And so my wife and I led that campaign here in Illinois, and we got it enacted into law. Also the city of Chicago, because they have a $7 billion budget, and later in the U.S. Congress. And so we managed to get that done, but we paid a price. There was we didn't realize what would happen as a consequence. But anyways, back to the starvation.
What kind of price?
An FBI agent with whom I went to school in Ireland as a boy, FBI agent Joe Doyle, warned my wife and me that the crimes were about to be committed against us by his fellow FBI agents, that they had been bribed and subverted by MI5, the British version of the FBI. So I said, Joe, you're in law enforcement. We're not. What are you doing about it? He said, there's nothing he could do. I said, Joe, you swore an oath of office. You don't have an option. You must uphold the U.S. Constitution. And he said, it's all happening over my head. Well, I changed the subject because we could not conceive of the notion of a criminal FBI agency.
And we you should listen to my radio show more often.
Okay. Well, a few weeks later, the Langert family were murdered in Winnetka by a 16-year-old David Biro, somebody I'd never heard of before, nor did I hear of his victims. David Biro, 16-year-old, used FBI agent Lewis's .357 Magnum to commit the murders. The afternoon after the murders were found, the chief of police called in all the neighboring, the northern suburb police in to his headquarters in Winnetka and asked them to write the name of any possible suspect. When they collected the 3x5 cards, there was only one name. That was the name of the murderer. But FBI agent Buckley arrived the next morning and prohibited the police from pursuing their sole suspect, the murderer, and directed them to pursue the IRA. And he got Carol Marin, a major Chicago TV announcer, to break that news sometime later. And then he later framed me for it so cunningly that I was doomed. I was doomed, except that the murderer blabbed through his FBI cover into life without possibility of parole. He's serving life now without parole down in Pontiac, Illinois. Wow. On the day that he was convicted, FBI agent Buckley came crashing through our door and locked my wife and me up and two friends in the federal jail in downtown Chicago at LaSalle and Van Buren, Clark and Van Buren, and tried to imprison us for the rest of our lives. It took us 15 months, but we finally were able to prove through very expensive legal support that the only evidence against us, an FBI audio tape, was a criminal fabrication. They got away with that. I wrote the judge later demanding of Judge George Lindberg to please notify law enforcement of the felony crimes perpetrated in front of him in his courtroom. And he wrote back to me, I have the letters, telling me that as the judge in that courtroom, he could not do any arresting. I wrote back immediately and have got a receipt from the letter, a copy of that back, but I said, you, for some reason, you have misrepresented our demand, which we repeat. We did not demand that you make the arrest, but we did demand that you uphold the law by notifying law enforcement of the felony crimes perpetrated in front of you in your courtroom. He did not answer the second one. So he went at the time to Janet Reno, the Attorney General of the United States, and when she was replaced later, a few years later, we went to Ashcroft, and even later to Gonzalez, his successor. We didn't even go to Gonzalez because he was already in favor of torture, that we thought there was no point in going to him at all. But Ashcroft just ignored our calls and our letters. So that's what happened as a result of our efforts to be good citizens. It is truly shocking that, well, the same FBI agent later went to Ireland, still for MI5, bringing with him a man that the New York State Police provided an affidavit labeling him a lifelong criminal. The man's name is David Rupert. And they remained in Ireland until dismissed by MI5 the evening of August 15th, 1998, the evening of the murder of 29 people by means of a car bomb in Omagh, County Tyrone. That bombing was their mission accomplished. Now, I don't know that, but if they were dismissed that evening, something ended their purpose there. They framed a man in Ireland for OMA. And for some reason, the lifelong criminal was on the witness stand, essentially the sole witness, and he described being left alone in danger in Ireland by FBI agent Buckley when agent Buckley flew to the Atlanta Olympics at that bombing murder in Atlanta. And the Olympics was in 1996. So they were in Ireland all those years, except for this brief departure by Agent Buckley, the same man who framed me for the triple murders in Winnetka and locked us up in the federal lockup downtown and tried to imprison us for the rest of our lives. He and his FBI colleagues in Atlanta evidently performed Buckley's specialty with the FBI, and that is evidence fabrication. They were able to frame the security guard who had noticed the backpack on the grounds of the Olympic area and warned people away from it, but wasn't able to warn them all, and one person was killed. But they framed him for it. In fact, and he later was able to collect a few million dollars, but then died young. And by the way, Mary and I are the only two of the so-called Chicago Four who were framed at that time by Agent Buckley. Being framed by the FBI seems to be a life-shortening experience.
Well, thank God that you've stayed healthy. This is isn't it an interesting story? And you know, if I had heard this 20 years ago, I would have shook my head and said, "Wow, that doesn't sound like the FBI, really." But you know, I've heard so many reports of similar situations where there'll be honest, low-level FBI people, like the guy who warned you, and they're bucking their superiors who are infiltrated by some combination of, you know, higher up intelligence people and organized crime. and they organize and they commit these kinds of crimes. They commit false flag bombings like this one you're talking about in Ireland, and I guess the one in Atlanta too. Apparently there was a false flag strategy that the British were using against the IRA, and some of this has been revealed in the mainstream media. I remember an Atlantic Monthly magazine article from several years back that described how the worst IRA atrocities were actually committed by British infiltrators. And this is now on the record that the British would infiltrate the IRA and to sort of prove their bona fides, they would, you know, kill somebody or do a bombing or something. And they always made it really bloody. And this totally messed with the IRA's public image. It created havoc within the organization. A classic example of a kind of a counterinsurgency false flag strategy. We saw the same thing in Algeria in the 1990s when the Algerian government, supported by France and to some extent the US and the UK, murdered well over 100,000 people, blamed all of these murders on radical Islamists. And in fact, it was government death squads, and their victims were almost all supporters of the peaceful democratic Islamists who had been ready to sweep into power with 90% of the vote in 1989, 1990. But then their leaders were captured and tortured to death. And then these death squads went into operation and murdered all the, you know, their supporters in false flag bombings and crushed this movement. So we see this over and over, this kind of criminal activity by the deep state. And what you just described to me totally jives with everything I've heard in the last 10 years investigating these things.
Well, it does, except for one thing. What we were doing was what all good citizens should be doing. I also engaged in a little bit of jousting in the letters pages of the Chicago Tribune and Chicago Sun-Times against the British Consul General. But the crimes were so risky on the part of the FBI, and the murders of people and the tremendous losses and expenditure of government of taxpayers' money was way out of proportion to what we were doing. And so we finally learned, just a few years ago, we finally learned what it was all about. And the neocons in America, and they happen to be strange, they happen to be hugely dual citizenship, dual citizens, Israeli Americans.
Tell me about it.
They were planning, well, they wrote a paper. A few years after they got started, they wrote a paper, Project for a New American Century. A key feature of that project was full-spectrum dominance. And full-spectrum dominance is, spelled out by them, the conquest of planet Earth and space. China and Russia are their ultimate goals. The Arab countries are the threshold to Russia. And North Korea is the threshold to China. And we would not know this, but the chief killer on the British side in the occupied six counties of Ireland, David Irvine, the head of the Ulster Volunteer Force, the murders of something like 800 people selected at random in Catholic neighborhoods, drive-by shootings, almost all of them. He was brought in triumph to the White House. And while there, later, when the, after 1998, both sides were sort of talked to by some PhDs who thought that the history of the struggles should be made clear while the participants are still alive. So they got people to say what they did, exactly what happened in those years from 1968 until 1993 or 4 or 5. And they had people from the Irish side and the British side. In this one book called Voices from the Grave, they have the transcribed words of two key people in Belfast. One is Darkie Hughes, an IRA man, and the other is the local head of the Ulster Volunteer Force, David Irvine. This David Irvine was brought again in triumph to Washington, D.C., at the White House, having led the murder of around 800 noncombatants because of who they were. He accused what he called the head of the State Department's Britain desk. He accused that person of siding with the IRA, and the entire American government of siding with the IRA. And that person replied, On the contrary, we are on the British side. The IRA don't have Buccaneer bombers, that's his word. They don't have aircraft carriers. And we need to sew up SEW up, the British Exchequer, so we can use the British forces in our upcoming wars. And David Irvine, then the next sentence, we all looked at him, the head of the State Department's Britain desk, and he said, Islamic fundamentalism. And David Irvine, then next sentence is, that was in 1998. Sorry, that was in 1994, precisely. That was in 1994, and I was not alone. There are witnesses. So that then allowed me to know what the major crimes were, that these relatively minor crimes were merely stepping stone toward. The murder of the Langer family in Winnetka, Illinois, was used to terrorize Irish America away from supporting the IRA, because the word was put out, this is an IRA murder of people in a Chicago suburb. Meanwhile, other supporters of Irish Republicanism around in New York and Boston and San Francisco, Fort Worth, different places, were all locked up, just like my wife and I and two others here in Chicago. And so that terrorized them. Then the bombing, the murder of the 29 people in Omagh, County Tyrone, it was an IRA bomb, but it was an MI5 FBI massacre. And they were able to blame it on, and they've gotten away with that one, well, roughly, so far. All of the other major atrocities, in fact, precisely, at least the ones that were never prosecuted, were all British state crimes. That is to say, the Dublin-Monaghan bombings, the murder of 33 and maiming of 300, the Bloody Sunday when the British Army shot down 14 people, 14 dead, mostly shot in the back. The massacre at Ballymurphy, the massacre of the people in the bar in Lochan Island, the McGurk's pub bombing and shoot up. All of these are unsolved, unprosecuted. Everyone knows the perpetrators, but the perpetrators are above the law. They work for the British government. Their names are known in many cases. And so that's what we're faced with. These people and Omagh, of course, they framed Michael McKevitt, a brother-in-law of Bobby Sands, for Omagh, but they never proved he was there. They never proved he had a single thing to do with it. He was imprisoned for 14 years for membership in the IRA. But then they got the news media in the second sentence of every TV report or newspaper report, the real IRA bombed Omagh. And it is a fact. It was a real IRA bomb, but it was a satellite-surveilled bomb car. MI5 and the FBI knew where the car was every inch of the way it went to the parking spot. They were able to control what parking spots to fill and what parking spots to leave open. It was totally arranged, and they've gotten away with that. They didn't get away with all the other atrocities I mentioned. Are all known, none are prosecuted, and the perpetrators are all named, except in a few, but most of the perpetrators are named, and nothing can be done about them because it was the British government, and the British government is not prosecutable. That's where justice stands in Ireland. And what's more, the criminal FBI agents committing their crimes, we thought they were committing the crimes originally for MI5. But MI5 and the FBI were actually working, now we have learned, years later, for the neocons. Mm-hmm. There was a bigger picture here. These were merely preparation for truly horrendous crimes, the supreme crimes, the destruction of nations.
Yes.
And that's where we are today.
That's really interesting. And this kind of connects with another Holocaust and genocide expert I've had on the show. Actually, he's becoming a regular favorite guest, Gideon Paglia. He's a Jewish professor, a science professor from Australia, and he's done a lot of work on comparative Holocausts and genocides. And the result of that is that the British look like the world champions in perpetrating Holocausts and genocides. Ireland is just one example of the many mass famines that they've imposed on nations and the millions and millions of people they've slaughtered in so many countries all over the world. But Gideon Polya is also well known for discussing the 9/11 triggered Holocaust in Muslim countries. And he calculates about 32 million Muslims have been murdered in these 9/11 wars. Of them, maybe about 27 or 28 million have died from preventable causes due to the effects of these wars indirectly. And then the other maybe 3, 4, or 5 million have been killed directly in these wars. So what you're talking about, the ongoing Holocaust of Ireland by the British and the banksters who own them, and the troubles in Ireland, morphing in the 1990s into the prelude to the so-called War on Terror, which is, of course, a genocidal war on the Islamic world on behalf of Israel and the neocons. This all kind of ties in. And we're talking, I mean, the real genocide perpetrators, the worst ones on earth, it's not Hitler and the Nazis. It's his enemies, the British and the banksters who own the British. And it was those same banksters who put Hitler in power. So this is the kind of stuff that you're not allowed to say in mainstream academia and the mainstream journals and the journalism. But that's what this radio show is for. And it's great that you're telling the truth about this stuff and helping get it out there. But this leads, of course, to the next question, which is, you know, my specialty has been studying 9/11 itself, which it turns out, based on my investigation, is a supremely obvious false flag operation. These three buildings, these huge skyscrapers, were obviously blown up. They didn't fall down from minor office fires kindled by kerosene jet fuel. And I could go on, and I often do. So have you looked into that, the atrocity perpetrated on 9/11 and who was really behind it?
Yes, well, I have what's called the normalcy bias. I do really want to believe what our government tells us. And so I didn't, it all looked really, really bad to me, but I didn't act against it. But building number 7 is a question mark that will remain until those crimes are finally investigated. Building number 7 is the one thing that destroys the whole 9/11 commission and what they wrote.
You know, that's a great point. I've been able to, you know, I know so many people have so much resistance to this. And once they do look into building number 7, they may not join me in the great 9/11 truth movement and get into all the details of this, but they suddenly quickly realize that there's something very, very wrong here. So, boy, we're sure living in a world of illusions created by essentially psychopaths in power. It seems that psychopaths have been in power for a long time, if not forever. What can we do about this?
That is the question of our time, of our entire age. It's been going on now for quite a few centuries, and they're gathering power. In indebtedness is growing apace. It's a form of slavery, and you don't have to have title to the person anymore. You can just get a title to their income. It is truly shocking, and young people who know they need an education and have been bilked by a combination of universities and banksters into indebting themselves is really shocking. I would think that Americans are going to wake up. I tend to be an optimist, and I think that in the three choices, the trifurcation that's going on regarding full spectrum dominance, either we take over the world, as say the neocons complete their mission, take over the world and turn the rest of us into slaves, or we fail to do it and destroy the world. The whole planet is destroyed. We're all dead. Or we go bankrupt in the process. The best of the three is that the West would go bankrupt, or the neocons would put the West into bankruptcy in the process. That's the best of that three. But maybe the American people will wake up, because we are now the most disinformed people on earth, so far as I know, at least regarding American policy. See, the people in Ireland are just as disinformed regarding Irish policy. The people in England are just as disinformed in terms of British policy. But we have an inkling of the policies of these when they're foreign nations. And so maybe a one, I've never thought of this before, but maybe one world government might be the way, because in that way, we would be able to look beyond the propagandists who are plaguing us within our own milieu.
Well, that's an interesting thought, kind of heretical in the
yes.
part of the alternative yes. media. But if there were a world government with sort of a congress of peoples in which the people had local autonomy and could use the world government to defend their local autonomy, that is, if the Irish had a kind of a world congress made up of other indigenous peoples who could help protect Ireland from the rapacious British and so on and so forth for other peoples, maybe that type of world government from the bottom up rather than from the top down would be a good thing. I know people who think that. David Ray Griffin, John Cobb, two of my colleagues in the 9/11 truth movement are on board with that. So you may be onto something, but again, that's a very heretical thought among the freedom lovers and the alternative information
yes,
folks.
Yes, yes. By the way, do you happen to know Chris Bolin?
Yes, I do. Chris Bolin. Christopher Bolin's a friend of mine, and you know he's a colleague, and we spoke together at the Nation of Islam conference last spring in Detroit in front of 4,000 to 5,000 people, the biggest audience ever for a 9/11 truth event, along with Richard Gage of Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth. So, yeah, I think Christopher has done some very good work.
He also has had very serious crimes perpetrated against him. We share a certain background, he and I, but I've never met the man, and I certainly wish him well, and I hope he remains safe.
I'm sorry, Chris. I'm going to have to cut out because I'm told that there's a break running that I can't hear. So thank you so much. It's been great to have you on. Look forward to more conversation down the line.
Great. Thank you very much. Bye.
Okay, take care. Bye.